It is Saturday, May 8th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news, in the second half, your questions and comments about technology. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxel. Please keep in mind the views expressed on Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme song is by Dave Patera. If you'd like to join him and participate by making music for Geek Speak, please do so by sending us your ideas and the music at geekspeak.org. Geek Speak is a Creative Commons endeavor. Share and share alike. My name is Lyle Troxel, and welcome. The geeks today are Miles Elam and Al Luckow. Morning, guys.
Good morning.
Morning.
And before we start that, I'd like to do some listener feedback.
I came across a posting in our forums at geekspeak.org. It's by listener Lowstone. He says, I cracked up when I heard you guys saying how amazing Google Goggle was, and you were able to find the red button that was just lying around the office. And it said you could buy it at Staples. Not sure if it's actually a trademark of Staples, but certainly an advertisement for them. Go to their website and you'll see the button on the front page and on every circular. A fairer test of the goggle would be to click on something like a baseball glove or a fishing pole or something a little more difficult to find. Or could this be GeekSpeak product placement? Are you guys shilling for the big bucks? Well, Lowstone, yes. It was I, Al Luckow, who mentioned the red button. And you caught me. Staples paid me $2 million for that product placement. Or should I say, paid us. But the fact is, all of us hosts are millionaires and are secretly controlling the government. GeekSpeak is just a cover so that we can recruit for our Knights of Templar faction in Santa Cruz. Why, just the other day, I moved some cement pavers in the garden. You know how I know how to do that? Because I'm a mason. The public has no idea the power that GeekSpeak wields. Do you actually think we're using our real names on the radio? Lyle, our leader, is the one we know as Wachautis Madronis. Miles here is Anoius Programicus, and I am known simply as Interfacium. So Lowstone, you may think you have discovered our secret, but you have no idea what you are dealing with. Our organization runs deep. We have symbols throughout the world. You know that carnival thing made out of straw that you put a finger in both ends and then it tightens your fingers and your fingers are stuck? We're behind that. And that horseshoe puzzle where you have to unhook the horseshoes? That's one of ours too. And Sudoku? Why do you think everyone's playing it all of a sudden? Soon we will have control of governments in 10 countries with factions on all the continents. We will control the presidents. Online retailers like Staples will bow down to us. Our power will grow exponentially until we become bigger than Oprah. Yes, Lowstone, we know who you are, and we'll be watching your every move.
Thank you, Al, for giving the feedback, listener feedback. I appreciate it.
Just public service.
Want to get everything clear about what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, Miles, what's going on with FCC?
The FCC recently has made a push to enforce net neutrality, a real strong push for us about that. Now, it's gone back and forth. They tried previously, and they were slapped down saying, no, you can't do this as just a general recommendation. You need to go through the longer process. And they're looking, and the FCC chairman now decides, let's go for a middle path. Getting a lot of pushback from the internet carriers, AT&T, Comcast, Verizon, and no one is really happy about it. You have, or rather,
you mean the middle path? No one's happy about the middle path.
pretty much, or at least many Republicans are upset about the fact that it's not. They're questioning how good the legal standing is that it's working from, and the carriers such as Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, they don't want net neutrality. I mean, just right away. And this was even brought forth with Verizon saying a little while back, or the Verizon CEO saying in front of Congress when asked, where does the U.S. lie with regard to broadband mm-hmm. access? He said, number one, not even close.
Right. Which we know is actually ridiculous because every study shows that's not the case.
Right.
Right.
Except for one. There is one study that came up, but it turns out that study was funded by the industry.
Can you give me a rundown on what net neutrality is?
Net neutrality, it depends on who you ask, unfortunately. Mm. But net neutrality in general is that you have paid for your internet connection. Someone like Yahoo or Google or Microsoft has paid for their internet connection. And the cable company or your phone company is the middleman.
Okay.
So the idea is that both sides have paid for their access to the pipes, mm-hmm. as it were. What net neutrality would do is allow carriers such as Comcast, such as AT&T, such as Verizon to be able to prioritize traffic that they deem appropriate. So, for example, if Comcast had a deal with ESPN to make sure that ESPN's content were streaming and worked very well on their network,
while other things didn't work,
while other things may be sacrificed,
and then that's not net neutrality,
right? Okay. That's not net neutrality. Net neutrality is saying no, you don't get to do that. You don't get to determine what your content is. You are providing access to the content, but you are not responsible for the content.
So the long and short of this is if the cable and the internet providers were able to control this in this way, they could go over to Hulu or Google for YouTube or ESPN and say, give us more money. We'll give you more money or make sure all of our customers can access you faster than anybody else, and therefore kind of giving a lean towards them so that their customers
upping up their quality of service that way, yeah.
Right.
There's also that fear of going the other direction, saying pay us or things are going to get scratchy for you. Having something like a YouTube and say you either pay us the extra money or YouTube starts skipping more often, has to rebuffer more often.
Right, right. And the way it works now, or the way it's by default worked, is that you never had that kind of filtering or envelope manipulating?
On the contrary, we did. In the early days when you had Prodigy accounts, AOL accounts, stuff uh-huh. like that, they were very much walled gardens. They were very much cut off. And then you had the proliferation of the internet. And you had people going out and going to whatever site was available and people opening up a storefront wherever they
right.
wanted to. And people switch from one service to another. They'll switch over from, say, Alta Vista as a search engine over to Google was very fast. Google showed up and it seemed like almost overnight people were using mm-hmm. Google.
Mm-hmm. And because the service was better.
Right. I mean, something new came up and it was the same amount of bandwidth. In fact, probably a little bit less bandwidth because Google's engine is so much more Spartan, more sparse. And people were able to decide where they wanted to go. One article I've seen, or one comic I've seen that was a parody but still had a grain of truth to it, was imagine you sign up for Comcast Internet and, okay, $5 more gets you YouTube, Hulu, mm-hmm. and then another $5 package will get you ESPN, and very much how cable is done
sells,
right now,
yeah.
but applying it to the Internet.
Right.
And that's where net neutrality comes in, is saying, do we allow that?
Right.
And what is free market? Free market may be, for some people, net neutrality, as in they don't get to decide. The consumers decide directly, or right. that laissez-faire attitude may be people saying, no, Comcast, AT&T, they're competing with each other. They should be able to do what they want.
Right, and so, therefore, I'm going to buy the service that I like the most. And if they restrict, if one of them restricts or charges more for YouTube, then I would just go buy a different
right.
consumer. But there's not that many choice. I mean, right now, from my home, there's only
right.
a couple broadband choices.
Right.
And if they're both going to charge for YouTube.
This is the debate that's going on.
Right.
There's a lot of money at stake. There's a mm-hmm. lot in terms of privacy or in terms of...
What's the GeekSpeak stance?
The GeekSpeak stance? I don't know what your stance is.
Well, I know that if somebody were... if somebody were able to control the buffering on YouTube and to be able to restrict it or something like that, mm-hmm. they pretty much can control every aspect of my life.
Yeah.
So, I don't think that should be allowed.
Well, the thing is that YouTube is owned by Google. Google has some pretty deep pockets. So if it really came to shove, Google could probably pay for the amount. The chances right. are that the information provider, the carrier, is not going to throw money away, is not going to turn down money, and is not going to charge more money than someone can afford, especially a big player like right. YouTube with Google. So that's not...
Well, my stance specifically is I believe very strongly that when an internet service provider sells bandwidth, it shouldn't feel any kind of filter or anything. It should allow that to be open as possible. They should charge me the amount of bandwidth I use. That's it. I shouldn't look at how it's manipulated or changed based on where I'm going. That's my perspective.
There is actually another side of net neutrality, mm-hmm. which is talking about the protocol and whether you're prioritizing HTTP traffic, web traffic, over BitTorrent. And that's right. where the whole issue gets really muddy, is whether you're talking about content control in general or whether you're talking about prioritizing protocols, because the prioritizing of protocols already happens. Otherwise, BitTorrent would completely swamp the other networks and wouldn't be able to browse the web
right.
due to the number of connections going through.
Right. What we're talking about is different types of protocols. Like mail is a certain type of protocol, and the web in general. And then there's actually two different versions of web traffic, secure and non-secure. And then there's also BitTorrent and other services that run on top of the network. The internet.
Right. And BitTorrent, if it slows down just a little bit,
it's not going to affect anybody.
At a certain period of time, like for 5 seconds, and then it comes back again, you're not going to really notice that download speed. But if you're on the web and you click a website, and it takes you 15 seconds to get a response or 5 seconds to get even 5 seconds to get a response, you notice.
Right.
And you go, oh. So what the idea is for a lot of networks and network administration is you prioritize that web traffic to say, okay, everything else stop for a second. Okay, this web request is going through. The web request finishes. Okay, everything back to normal.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, so if that's the case, if there's more talk about prioritizing different types of communication, that makes sense.
But that's the thing, that both arguments are being mushed together.
Mm.
So it's really hard to get a good sense when people say net neutrality what they're talking about.
Are there people in Congress that actually know the topic well enough to discuss this?
Yes.
Okay, good.
But they are few and far between.
They're all the actually it's the pages.
All the pages understand.
And they understand this.
On the contrary, if you ever look at, I highly recommend folks look up YouTube videos about Al Franken talking with Comcast.
He knows a lot about.
Where he does, yes, there are other members of Congress that are very technically savvy.
Yeah.
There are many members of Congress that aren't. Not. But there are people up there that are fully cognizant of what's going on and holding different people's feet to the fire.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for the update on the net neutrality. What's going on with Google?
Yeah, I guess it's another Google story. I didn't really mean to.
That's okay.
Well, it's.
It means that we have a nice, wonderful segue.
Yes.
Thank you, Al, for planning that ahead of
yeah,
time.
Yeah, yeah. We planned all this. It's called Google Translate. It's there's an application on the web that you can go to by Google that allows you to translate any web page or any kind of thing, but. It turns out now it's actually quite accurate. A German scientist named Frank Ock has developed one of the first translation programs suitable for everyday use. And they say that the sheer computing power of Google that Google supplies it with, it gives surprisingly good results.
Hmm.
And this guy, he's the developer of this, and he even used it himself when he was in Japan and used it to translate menus in Japan. And, you know, when the developer himself uses it, you know, it's like it kind of becomes the person's, you know, actual, you know,
argument
baby.
Success.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a neat thing that, you know, these translation things have been around a long time and they always come out really goofy.
Yeah.
You know, you put something in, it comes out and it's just like, what? You know, I want to buy a horse. No, that's not what I said. You know, and this apparently is done much better the way they use the what they call the I guess language weaver is the sort of the technology behind this, and they'll take sentences like they give the example "Wir treffen uns im Schloss," and that's a German phrase, and if you search for something like that, it will look for the words "treffen" and "Schloss" and it'll look how they appear in like zillions and zillions of entries within Google's database to be able to figure out, because Treffen means meet and Schloss means castle or lock. So it could mean a couple different things. You know, want to meet the castle, meet you want to meet the lock, you know. Okay. So they're able to use all this massive data. I mean, it's just a matter of like critical mass where they're just, you know, searching all these like phrases and comparing and comparing. And that's how they got this this translation thing to really work well.
So what you're saying is that if it's a colloquial way of saying something, that that would actually still be translated, because it wouldn't go word for word. It would actually look at it in its use and go, oh, that means this because of its use.
Right. They're looking at common uses. Up till now, language has really been a matter of rules. You know, it's just an arduous, you know, agonizing task of creating rules and how to do it. But they're actually just taking all this data from the web and then using that to, you know, to translate with. The, the downside on that, of course, is that you have to be connected to the web in order to use this thing.
That actually is how Google's Translate engine works. They don't go word by word most of the time. They're actually looking at groups of words, actual phrases, looking at blocks and seeing that. I remember seeing a example of how to do RDF programming or RDF processing with a translation engine, and it was doing done in Python, very few lines of code, and it ended up being
chunks.
And it ended up being simpler and more accurate as a translation.
Cool.
And which kind of makes sense. It's human beings. Human beings are not logic engines,
right? We learn our language in mass knowledge, right?
So right, and also when we're learning it, most of us aren't able to just learn grammar and go, okay, so this is the structure and we do it. We follow the patterns in society.
Right.
And just emulate them.
Right. That's actually kind of why emulate, there's no real rules.
Yeah, our kids emulate our mistakes.
Right. So that means that this translate language is going to emulate our mistakes.
It's almost like living a living translator.
Personally, I've always wondered if anyone's ever applied this idea to, you have a colloquial speech, like everyday speech. Instead of translating it to a different language, translating it to the same language just with the rigid grammar rules, and then doing the translation to another language and doing a conversion from the formal to the colloquial. So a multi-step process instead of direct probably would be slower, but I wonder what it would do for accuracy.
Is the web mostly formal or mostly informal? Because if they're using this technique, how do you know what it is? I mean, that's the thing that's troublesome to me.
Language is mostly informal.
Yeah.
But at least online? Oh, yeah.
Well, tech documentation stuff.
I was thinking of IM Speak.
Yeah, but IM Speak isn't necessarily part of what their search is.
But most things aren't tech documentation.
Mostly blog entries.
Yeah.
Informal.
LiveJournal and things like that.
All right, cool. Thanks for the update on Google Translate. That was Al Luckout, and this is Miles Elam. Hi, Miles Elam.
Hello. Oh, you want my next story?
Well, your next story matches really well with, this is Miles Elam. The what's in a name?
In biology, one of the big titans of genetics has been the analysis of the Drosophila genus, in other words, the fruit fly.
Okay.
And because they have such a short lifespan, you're able to do so many generations and tweak out all sorts of different things and end up with eyes on elbows and stuff like that. And it really is a pillar of genetic research.
Using the fruit fly.
Except that when I say the fruit fly is not one single item, even with all the genetic research where they split things off. I mean, in terms of just the fruit fly itself, as a genus, it's still a huge number of organisms.
Really?
So there's a proposed reorganization of, for example, Drosophila melanogaster, which is, like I said, something used very much for genetic research.
That's the specific specimen species that we are normally using?
No, we use a whole range of species. Okay. But that's one of them, and it's a relatively big one, is going to be changed to a different genus. Because the genus is so huge, it's become unmanageable now.
Because of all the modifications?
That and just the fact that there is so much genetic diversity in the wild. But it's just become so big, they're like, okay, we need to split this up into two different genus. But one of the primary things that people think about with regard to Drosophila is going to be moved into this other genus.
Interesting.
And so this goes into the whole issue of, if you go back to previous papers and seeing what research has been done, suddenly the name has changed.
Oh, right, right.
And this happens in biology from time to time. Taxonomy is all about change, especially when they find out through genetic research, even though it's structurally the same, it's not actually the part of this tree. Something's part of another tree. Let's
move this
around.
Right, they're always learning a lot more about the classification system. That's true.
But Drosophila, like I said, is so much a central theme in biology and biological research that it looks to be a kind of disruptive change.
So they're going to rename its genus to be different than the other fruit flies?
It and a whole group of other ones.
Interesting.
It basically,
what's the separation they're actually using to determine the new genus?
Looking at just the genetic model of each of them, yeah.
Interesting. So,
seeing which ones
we got
follow
family and then genus and then species, right?
Right.
Okay.
Oh wait.
Class, order, family, genus,
species. Family, genus, species.
What's
right.
the upper ones? Starts with life.
Kingdom, phylum, class.
And phylum. What's the separation? Phylum.
What's what? I'm sorry.
Here's an example of phylum separation. I always find this interesting because I never know what the actual classifications are. I don't know. We'll talk about biology sometime. All right, let's move on. thank you, Miles, very much for that story. I've lost track of where I am. Oh, here I am. Good. So it's definitely Al's turn. And what's going on in space?
Oh, I ran across this YouTube video. It's a video of the International Space Station, and it's really, really cool. We'll have a link on geekspeak.org.
It's a YouTube of the space?
It's a YouTube, and it's about 5 minutes long. And it's got, like, some cool music, and there's this guy, and he's saying, hey, welcome to the space station. What we're going to do is we're going to take you from one side of the space station and go all the way across to the other side and then eventually inside the space shuttle. So he starts out, and there's, like, a cameraman.
Is this real or
random? This is real.
Oh, cool.
And so the guy is floating, and it's just in this tube. And he just starts moving down the space station. He's like saying, oh, and there's the Japanese area right there. That's the Japanese electro something or other. And
let's stop the show and watch this right now.
Here's the Russian. Yeah, I mean, here's the Russian area. They're doing some experiments. They just got, and there's like stuff all over the place. He's like in a big tube. And he's just going. Everything's like in white wrappers. And there's like bags of stuff. He's like, oh, this is like, I think this is food. And every part of the wall is like a panel. It's like a real spaceship. I mean, we've seen all these movies of people, you know, in spaceship and, you know, Captain Picard and all this kind
of
stuff.
Wait, so you're telling me so everything is a series of tubes?
Yeah, it is. And it's kind of claustrophobic. I mean, there's spots, okay, we're going to go through here. And then he like goes to this like little tiny tube spot, you know, and it's like, man, if you have claustrophobia,
there's
no way you could be on the spaceship. And then he's like, oh, and then he goes around this corner, there's a guy there, you know, and he's like, oh, this is Yuri Bropinov, you know, and he's working on this thing. And and then he waves, and then he goes, and he just goes in all these weird maze things. And then there's like another guy like there, just in the middle, crouched in something. And there's like all these people up there. And then he ends, and he goes all the way to the space shuttle, and he goes through the dock. And it's something I think that, you know, we all know about the space shuttle. We all know there's things up there. But this is a really, for me, it was the first time to actually see it in a way that was digestible, you know, not just some weird thing. And it was just like the guy was really casual and, you know, floating. You watch him float through. It's really in space. It's something about it. It's just, you know, magical. I think
anybody
who pays taxes should see this because they want to know what they're paying for.
We'll have that up on geekspeak.org, a great tour of the International Space Station. It is middle of a show, which means that I want to let you know that GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. I also want to let you know that this week I have been learning Objective-C and iPhone and iPad development, thanks to Stanford's wonderful online courses at iTunes U. So iTunes, the newest version, now has a iTunes U, which is university content. And Stanford's got some courses up there that every lecture's up there, class notes and documentation on Stanford's site, on assignments. And it's been great. I'm sitting on my back, doing a lot of laying on my back because of my broken back, and learning Objective-C. And Miles, you've done a little bit of Objective-C stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool. I mean, I'm definitely trying to get a feel for its differences. And, you know, I was assuming that it was going to be very much like C, and I'm familiar with C because of JavaScript, because they're very similar. But they're all just enough different where I still feel like I'm, you know, walking on uneven boards.
Yeah, once you're adding objects, it gets away from C, and C's just using structures and direct memory management. And it isn't direct function calls, it's message passing, which if you're not used to it, if you haven't done it before, it becomes very strange. But it's also the reason why it allows for loose binding, even though it's a compiled language, that it allows you to change your UI but have your code stay the same.
Right.
That actually does the horsepower underneath.
What we're talking about, normally you say, run this function, you pass a very specific variable. Instead, what you do now is you say, hey, thing out there, here's a message for you. And if that thing responds to it or not, it's up to the object that you're calling, which is kind of neat in that sense that you can – it's loose in that perspective. It's very similar to Maximus P, which is a visual environment, which does message passing as well. So I'm familiar in that sense. But it's been fun to learn it, and I highly – if you've got time on your hands, if you've recently broken your back and you're laying on your bed all the time, I highly recommend the iTunes U courses. There's tons of cool lectures, a lot of neat lectures out there. And you can even do courses that where you're doing assignments and stuff. So that's been really fun. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Hey, we're taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. You can ask us anything you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. Of course, that's toll-free, and I'll give those numbers a second. My name's Lyle Troxell. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz. In the air with me are Al Luckow, he's a new media architect, and Miles Elam, slacker and political junkie. What are you guys working on lately? Al? Keeping your clients busy?
Yeah. Unfortunately, if I told you, I'd have to kill you.
You have to lose your job.
Yeah. It's just that everything I do is like, I can't show anybody, and it's like, it's NDA world.
It's neat visiting your site, though. You can see what you used to do.
Yes, you can see what I was doing, and then, even what I have there is mostly security through obscurity. It's just like not really linked.
Yeah. But you're a busy guy.
That's my life.
Miles, what are you working on?
iPhone development, but with from the website,
using
JavaScript, CSS, different animations that way, SVG, Canvas work. And strangely enough, outside of coding, learning Keynote, learning to do that better to make better presentations.
To teach better.
Yeah.
Keynote's a great app. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, they're using Keynote for this Stanford series thing I'm taking.
I believe it.
Yeah.
They want it to look good.
Yeah. It's cool, too. I mean, some of the effects are quite nice. Keynote's very similar to Microsoft's, I'm blanking.
PowerPoint,
thank you.
Except?
Different.
Well.
Well, it's done better. PowerPoint is sort of a legacy app. It's turned into bloatware, and they're just trying to make it work. And a lot of people become good at it simply through rote memorization and just trying to hammer away. And Keynote, I think, was developed in kind of, they used a newer technology. There's a lot easier things. There's better transitions. They're accessing better engines. It's actually a really great way to prototype.
And they also decided, maybe just a single slide with a whole bunch of words isn't the most aesthetically pleasing and engaging format to have things
in. I know. I've just been doing these PowerPoint presentations lately and, for clients. And they just, they tend to, want to put an encyclopedia on a thing. And it's just, I don't know how to tell them that, hey, nobody can read this. They can't see it. It's a word. You might as well not put anything. Why don't you break this into, five slides? It's all got to be there. Yeah,
That and reading from the slides, worst possible
don't
presentation
read
from
the
format.
Slides.
Oh. You put the highlights up on the slides and maybe like a graphic to show your overall concept, and you talk to something.
Yeah, what you're going to say and what's on the slide should be very different.
Yes, very different.
And it's cool, too, because if you're prototyping, say for the iPad, I was working on this prototype for an iPad. Mm-hmm. You can build your Keynote presentation, normally it's sort of in tall, like you would normally do it. And then when you're ready to, to show a client, you can actually play it on an iPad, but you have to select every piece of it and then turn it sideways so that when you play it, you can actually hold your iPad up and it'll look like a complete iPad. There's no interface around it or anything.
Oh,
you can put the same backgrounds in, and it's even got hotspots, and you can just actually...
So you're using it for prototyping.
So you can actually say, hey, here's our thing, and you can hook an iPad to a projector, so you can do this whole thing like that.
Have you bought an iPad for yourself yet?
No, but one of my clients has one, and I was... in Keynote, you can get the Keynote for the iPad.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Not the same functionality, though. There's a couple of differences.
Well, not for creating, but you can play back all the Keynotes that you'd make, right?
You can play them back, but there's things like if you have grouped objects, they don't stay grouped. There's some transitions that don't function on the iPad like they do on the computer.
So test first.
Right, so it's definitely worth testing first.
And you can't print from the iPad.
You can't print from the iPad?
From any app. You can't print.
Not really. Yeah.
Well, paper's so passe if you have an iPad.
No, I was actually thinking if you could, my girlfriend and my mom would both have
just
one
switch.
Now. That, yeah. They were my mother was actually having problems with a laptop just because it's a whole new medium for her. And she's like, well, but what I'm doing is just checking email. And she loves her iPhone. So having a bigger screen of the exact same thing would be wonderful
for
her.
There'll be somebody that comes out with a little box that's actually a computer that prints, that syncs the iPad and does that.
Yeah, I mean, but, it's not far away. No. That's for sure.
I'm surprised there's not something that you can do it with. I mean, you can. Well, let's see. We got we're taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 476-2800. That's 831 area code. Or toll-free anywhere in the continental U.S. and beyond a little bit is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. All right, so as we wait for calls to come in, let's go ahead and take another call from, or another story from Miles. What's going on with Verizon?
A little while ago, a couple, or family, got a $18,000 phone bill from Verizon.
Ouch.
Right. Now you'd think like, well, hey, maybe it's a really large family, but no, actually, it's just a standard nuclear family, which you would expect from... you know, three people, two parents, mm-hmm. and a son.
What were they doing?
What had happened was when they first got their phones, there was a trial offer for unlimited data. And so you start checking your email and start checking the web and doing all these things. But they didn't really read closely to the fine print that it was only a trial period. And after the trial period, you start paying a amount per kilobyte.
Oh.
Per kilobyte?
Per kilobyte.
Ooh. So give people an idea, Lyle, on what a kilobyte is. How much data is a kilobyte?
What's a good reference to this, Miles? Text document.
One standard email.
An email.
So
that's
one
good.
Email is like...
Without attachments.
Yeah. And here's the thing, though. A YouTube video is more like 1,000 of those.
Yeah.
So were they watching like video?
Well, their son was... browsing the web, and I'm sure looking at YouTube videos, and basically doing everything he had done the previous month with no issue. And so it comes back as being this, the first month is a $12,000 bill, or somewhere there a little more than, and that they have another few thousand already accrued for the following month.
Right.
And, you know, the parents are shocked going, wait, what? There's what? And
$1,200 bill? What's that?
Right.
Not $1,200.
$12,000.
Right. Now, for my cell phone bill, I actually have a family plan.
You have unlimited data.
I have unlimited data, but I don't have unlimited text messages. Mm-hmm. And recently, both my girlfriend and I went over slightly. And so it ends up being, you know, an extra $8 more on the bill, something like
it's
that.
It's annoying.
And considering the fact that 200 messages costs $5... and then the extra, you
30
know,
messages.
You know, like 13 messages, you know, ends up being a nice chunk more, ends up being more than the bill, the original
more than
bill
double
itself.
The rate. Yeah, right.
You go like, okay, that's kind of painful, but I can deal with that. It's like, oh, we went over. We have to decide, like, is it worth it to go up to the next level, to cut back? But this type of thing,
a multiple
like,
of 10,000.
If you're expecting your phone bill to be, for your whole family, $150.
Right.
Maybe 200.
Maybe 200 bucks, yeah.
Then suddenly having $18,000, you do have to wonder, and this is a question, an open question to the audience. I'd really love to hear your feedback and hear different people's perspective. Do you say, well, they signed the contract, they should have known that this was a trial offer and to watch out for that, or should Verizon have something in place that says, hey, we already see on the first day that you have tripled your bill.
Right.
Do you want to – is there something you need to know? There's something you need to know.
That would be a good service to offer.
I think it's this gross irresponsibility on the part of Verizon to let something go to that level. I mean, to an average person, that's really weird. Oh, their bill was 100, now it's 18,000.
Yeah, if the bill's 100 times bigger than it has ever been before,
they
should contact the customer or freeze the service or something.
I think the credit card companies do that. Like, if I buy something expensive, you know, and I happen to be in, you know, Czechoslovakia – You know, they'll say, hey, this is funny. You just bought something really expensive in Czechoslovakia.
The other thing is that Verizon offers an unlimited plan. It's probably pretty expensive.
For $30 a month.
So what they should do is say, you know what? You messed up. You're getting the $30 plan, and we're going to bill you $500 as a penalty. Mm-hmm. That is like, okay, I can see that. It's a few months of penalty, you know, equivalent to 3 or 4 months of their phone service as a penalty to not do that again.
Right.
And they are getting an unlimited plan, which they should have had in the first place.
And the fact that someone was asking, well, how much is a kilobyte? How do we explain that to folks?
That's the part.
That's something that isn't coming across to consumers. To say this is a price by kilobyte isn't helpful.
Right.
It's kind of like saying let's say, you know, on the highway you see, and this is something that's been brought up by Professor Kishoff, a professor of computer science at University of Waterloo, when he was talking to Congress about it. What carriers are doing is akin to governments posting signs of the speed limit as 16.6 centimeters per millisecond.
Right.
Instead of 40 miles per hour. Technically, it's correct.
Right.
And someone could do the calculation. Most people who have gone through, you know, pre-algebra should be able to do that math. But it's not intuitive. It's not anything that people are going to know right off the bat, and they're not going to know they're going to be getting in. It's just, wait, what? It's how
Of course,
much?
We don't have an intuitive language for data yet. And it also changes so fast. I mean, what would they do? I mean, in the car analogy, you'd say, well, use miles per hour because everyone knows and understands what that is. But in the data analogy, how do you say that to people?
A 5-minute YouTube video costs this much.
Right.
Each email costs this much. When you say an email costs about, you know, is about 1 kilobyte. You know, an email with an attachment, so you assume that's going to be like 25 kilobytes.
Right. Yeah, okay. So you'd give some examples. I mean, they do that with MP3 players when they sell them. You know, this is a 500-song MP3 player.
Yes, exactly.
And Tuskegee's
that's exactly
are like, well,
what's
how big
going
is it?
On. Yeah, how many videos, how many songs? That's a common nomenclature, and that's what you do when you're trying to market to people. How much are you getting? Because 40 gigabytes doesn't mean anything
to most people.
The other thing
is, you know, we're not in a situation where you save YouTube videos. You don't really know how big they are. You don't say. I mean, there's no place where it says how big they are.
No.
It says, and that's the thing is data transfers. If you're not saving the data, you don't really know how big it is.
Right. Most of them are. You're pretty. You have a good baseline to say whether it's the standard definition or the high definition for YouTube videos, and then working it by length. You're actually pretty.
No, by
good.
Length is fine, but.
Yeah. You're
that's
pretty good by
talking.
Those as two metrics to work
yeah,
off.
I mean,
of,
well,
yeah,
I mean, what is the? I mean, I can tell you MP3
a standard definition YouTube video that lasts 5 minutes. You know,
would
then
be
to give
this
a number.
Big. Yeah. Do you know how big that is? I don't.
I would imagine it's somewhere in the order of
it's probably a 300x200 resolution.
Yeah, if I were to just throw out a number, I'd say 50-75 megs.
Yeah. And that's 75 megabytes, so that's 1,000 times more than the kilobyte.
Right.
It's actually 1024 big. But.
So 50,000 or 70,000 kilobytes.
Yeah.
And there you get an idea of where that Verizon bill came from, which they're charging by the kilobyte, even if by the kilobyte is only a tenth of a cent.
One GeekSpeak episode is about 26 megs or 25 megs. Hmm. So there you go.
Of good quality audio, yeah.
Excellent quality audio. I don't know about the
It's audio anyway.
There you go. Speaking of audio, let's keep on going with the show. From Pacific Grove, Gene, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Well, thank you. Before I ask my question, let me do a Verizon question for you.
Okay.
They gave those people 30 days free to go crazy, and then they whomped them. Why did they give them that? I mean, is there a plan that Verizon would offer then saying, you can have all that and we'll charge you $200 a month or something?
$30 a month, actually, is what they wanted.
Really?
For unlimited, yeah.
Well, some of those people should have done that, I guess. Right?
They should have done that.
My question is, I'm not
a
geek.
Or they wish they had done it, yeah.
They wish they'd done it. I'm not a geek, and I have I switched to the Mac, and I have Mac with Leopard. Love my Mac. Snow Leopard comes out. Don't hear anybody talking about it. It's not like a Windows upgrade. I don't hear people saying, you have to have Snow Leopard.
Mm-hmm.
What's involved in me getting Snow Leopard? Should I get Snow Leopard?
How old
do
is
I
your
care?
Mac? How old
my
is
Mac,
your Mac
is 2 years.
Okay, so it's an Intel Pro. It's a MacBook or a MacBook Pro?
Or an iMac?
No, it's a Mac. It's the desktop.
Oh, okay.
The iMac.
So it's an iMac.
That your machine can run Snow Leopard.
Sure.
Snow Leopard is a slight improvement. The feature set that they really improve with are things that are hard to promote to people, hard to sell it, because there's not, right, when you say it?
Yeah.
You know, if I were to, if you were to, okay, if you're asking me as an individual, this is Miles Edelman on GeekSpeak, do I think you should upgrade to Snow Leopard? I think you should pay the $30 and upgrade to Snow Leopard.
Right.
I but I don't know that you're going to see a dramatic difference.
There's a few things, a few interface things that allow you to control the size of the icons, little sliders, and just a lot of nice things that there are UI things that you'll probably notice as a user. But there's a lot of underlying stuff that sort of cleans up some messy things. I used Leopard for a very long time from the day one, and then yeah. I upgraded to Snow Leopard. And I don't know that, don't expect to be bowled over, but it's certainly an upgrade. You know, it's better. It can actually cause some problems with a few applications, too. What kind of applications are you running on this?
I do basic. I've got Office and do eBay and email.
Yeah, you'd probably be fine. You might as well upgrade.
But that's already
You're asking us, and yeah. I mean, we're going to say, hey, get the newest, and it's cheap. Yeah. It's like, the value you get when you upgrade.
Yeah. Going on Wikipedia's site and looking up Mac OS X Snow Leopard, it lists like 20 things or 15 things that are new, right? Bootcamp now can use Windows partition. The Finder's written in 64-bit native.
Does it do something in the iTunes?
Nothing. Well, iTunes is going to be upgraded anyway, so you always have the newest version of iTunes. They make it for the last three versions of OS because they want iTunes to be up to date. QuickTime 10, the new QuickTime player, we actually don't like very much compared to the 7 because of the pro version.
He might like it.
You might like it, though. Yeah. It's a nice thing. Mm-hmm. Time machine connections are better. I mean, there's all these things that are like, yeah, they're beneficial, but it's not like... That's why they added the Snow, right? That's why it's kind of a similar name because it's not a giant overhaul. But I would recommend it. I use it.
Yeah, my take on it is it's a little bit more efficient, but Apple also will drop support, or different application vendors will drop support for apps after the operating system gets two or three revisions old. So you're starting to see more and more applications that aren't available for Tiger anymore.
They have to have Leopard. Yeah.
So that's actually my main motivation to tell you upgrade, because it doesn't cost that much, and it makes sure that you're not being left behind, when you get get some new software and it doesn't work.
And it's fun.
Right, and we wouldn't want to be the left behind.
That's right.
Well, it's fun. A cheap way not to be left behind. It's not like buying a whole new computer.
You feel like you get something new, though. I mean, it's like, this is kind of different. There's a new thing. And
thank you, Gene.
Okay, cool. Thank you a lot.
Thanks for listening. Bye. Let's go ahead and take another call, this time from Santa Cruz. Aaliyah, welcome.
Hi. Good morning. I'm enjoying your show a lot. I really appreciate your Saturday morning show. I had a software question for you. Mm-hmm. I'm running AVG on my wife's laptop, my laptop, and my desktop. And recently I purchased a Internet Security Netbook Edition from Norton that includes antivirus, anti-spyware, identity protection, Norton SafeWeb, smart firewall, browser protection, et cetera, And one of my friends who is pretty knowledgeable about computers said that Norton uses a lot of disk space and is pretty invasive as far as taking over the computer is concerned.
Okay.
And I've heard, varying opinions about it. I'd like your insights. Do you think that it's better to run the Norton software on our computers or better to stay with the AVG?
It's a tough one.
I don't think it'll make a difference.
Yeah.
If you're talking about doing a hard drive scan, especially with standard platters and not a solid state drive, they're all doing essentially the same thing. Some may be more advanced than another, so it may take half the time as another one, but you're still talking about a huge volume of time. I personally am not a big fan of the regular hard drive scan. I don't think it's necessary as much as when you're browsing the web, having that initial check to see if something goes on your system. So
right. It's better to be proactive.
I'm very much of that camp of when you first buy your antivirus, you do a full sweep of the system, and then you turn off the hard drive scan, except maybe once a month.
Yeah, and then manually run it once a month. Yeah, I agree. And then make sure to keep the filtering off for the email and stuff coming
right,
through.
Right, but all the email and web filtering and stuff like that, you absolutely leave that on.
Are you using AV free or AVG paid?
On one of the computers, I'm using AVG paid, and on the other two, I'm using AVG free.
Okay, the AVG paid, the paid services are just going to be better, right, because they actually are going to update their dictionaries better. And that's what you want to do. So if you're saying, should I use Norton? I've already bought it for other purposes. Should I use that versus the AVG free? I would say go ahead and use the Norton full. But if you're paid for AVG, then it's not going to be that different. The other argument would be that Norton is a more familiar and more popular application. And virus check, people that write viruses actually check them against applications. So the more obscure, in some sense, that your checker is, the more likely that they won't check against it. So that has to do with zero, like really early exploits, which you getting early exploits actually less common than you'd think. You'd think that your update would be your... I'm going down a trail that doesn't matter that much.
But also, with regard to antivirus, don't just stick with antivirus. Also, make sure you're doing Windows updates. Whenever it says, like, hey, there are updates that are available, do you want to install them? Like, save whatever you're working on and just do the update. It's just easier to tell people that rather than because they put it off. And also, when you're connecting them to the internet, use one of those home routers. Don't plug your computer directly into the cable modem or the DSL modem.
Yeah.
Please, because that's... Any effect you get from the antivirus is completely wiped out by not doing those other two things.
Right.
Tell me that again, please.
You're doing this because you have multiple computers, so you actually have something that shares the network connection between multiple computers. That's called a router, and we highly recommend having one of those. If you don't have one of those, it's kind of like just hanging out on the street. You know, you might have...
It's like walking through Times Square and picking up a random hypodermic needle and going, huh, I wonder what this does.
Maybe I'll be Superman. Yeah. Hey, thanks for the call.
All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
All right, bye-bye. From Santa Cruz again, Ed, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I've got a question about Mozilla Firefox browser.
Uh-huh.
I use that, and when I, on the address bar, I think it's called the address bar where you type in the web address, if I type in a search term like GeekSpeak, this page comes up that says myfreeze.com, and yes, that's become the default search.
Are you typing into the Google box in the upper right in Firefox? Is that what you're typing into?
No.
Does it have a little G on it?
No. That one works fine. But
it's a Yahoo search engine. My phrase is a Yahoo search engine.
And I'd like to change that to anything else but my phrase.
Okay, so Firefox uses, you can change the search engine you use in Firefox. But when you say you're using the search, are you doing it, up on the top, there should be two places to write things, the left-hand side and the right-hand side. Do you see those?
I do. I'm typing into the left-hand one.
Okay, don't type in the left-hand. Type in the right-hand one. And you see that the right to the on the right, up there should be like a little arrow next to that field.
Oh, yeah,
there.
Yeah.
I've dropped down?
I've got those all set up. But sometimes I type something in up here.
Yeah, the typing the left in the address bar, you have to really have the right address. If you just type something that's not a valid URL, it's going to go to the search engine that it chooses.
Yeah, actually, I have a quick question. Are you an AT&T customer?
No.
Okay, so I was just wondering, because Yahoo has some bundling things with ours. Wondering if that was coming up.
Well, how would I change that from myfreeze.com to to Google or...
Yeah, you're looking for your default search engine that's part of the browser, and I'm looking right now through the preferences of Firefox, and I can't find it right now.
In the Internet, in the Microsoft version, Internet Explorer... there's a place you can change it in tools. You can change the search default.
Right, and it's still not working for you?
That's an Internet Explorer. In Firefox, there is no analog that I've been able to find.
Well, there is a way to do it.
Yeah, if you go over to the right-hand side, that little search bar that's actually the search bar on the top, and you select that little drop-down box, then there's actually a thing at the very bottom that says Manage Search Engines?
Yes.
You can remove the one that you don't like. And you might be able to resort them. If you resort them, it's going to use them that direction.
I'm adding a thing that says how to change your default search engine in Firefox to our geekspeak.org
forum.
Forum. So that'll be up there after the show. Go to our show page and you'll be able to see instructions on how to do that.
Thank you for the call.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
All right. Take care, Ed. Let's take one more call quickly from Capitola. I think that'll be the last call for the day. Peggy, welcome.
Hi. I'm calling. I have a MacBook that's, I believe, 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And last year I started a blog, a travel blog under iWeb. But I still just have Leopard. I don't have Snow Leopard. For some reason, when I'm trying to get it back up and to publish it for my new vacation starting soon, it won't publish. It says that I need, I don't have it up right now. I can't really tell you, what it says.
You need a website. You need a WebDAV website.
It's they're leading me to MobileMe.
Right.
Is that what I have to get now?
You don't have to get it that way, but Apple makes it really simple to use it that way.
Okay.
You can actually do it other ways. You need something. You need a website that supports a protocol that's called WebDAV, which is an open standard protocol, which Apple really endorsed first in some sense and kind of has made very popular. Mm. And that actually is what their service is. Their MobileMe is actually a WebDAV system.
Right.
If you want to be simple and easy, yeah, you spend, what I think, $100 a month and you get their service.
A month? A year?
No, a year. I think it's something like that. I'm not really sure the price.
It is.
Yeah.
It
sure is easy when you do it that way.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I want. Easy.
And the other way you could do it is you could look around for another service provider. But, you know, a lot of website service providers are, you know, $6 a month, $7 a month, and that's getting pretty close.
Well,
so,
that's true.
There you go.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
I think that's all the calls we've got. Just to be clear on the drop-down Firefox search engine thing, we do have an answer. We'll have it up on the website. The best thing that happened, Dave from Santa Cruz sends in a note. The best thing that happened with snow leopard compared to leopard is that the screensaver images of a real snow leopard. And those are really pretty. So that's the reason why you want to get it. I think we did well on the show today. Is there anything you guys want to catch up before we do the USB at the break, at the end? Miles, you want to touch on that?
I'm all.
You're all
I'm
good?
All set, yeah.
All right. Maybe we should take one more call. I'm feeling a little strange. Robot news, quick, Al?
There's a bunch of different robot things. One of them, the German scientists are experimenting to see how much damage a robot could actually do. And they have this robotic arm, and they were stabbing, you know, big chunks of meat to see.
Why would they do that?
Well, they say that robots are going to be part of domestic servants, and they want to see exactly how. Three researchers from the Institute of Robotics and Metrotronics at the German Aerospace Agency wanted to carry out the test because they envisage a future in which robots will start to become domestic helpers.
Okay.
So they rigged up this arm to be able to stab these things. And I actually have that video. I'm glad that they were testing this just on a robot arm instead of, like, you know, using a giant, fully formed giant robot with massive jaws.
It's a good point.
You know, so whatever.
Hey, GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Whole Foods Market, featuring sliced beef and steak free of antibiotics, added growth hormones, and feed of 100% vegetarian diet. Whole Foods Market in Monterey, Capitola, and Santa Cruz. Wait, Don't Tell Me is a weekly hour-long radio quiz program. Each week, test your news against some of the best and brightest. You can play along too on the web. Go to Wait. And that's Wait, Don't Tell Me, today at noon on Central Coast Public Radio. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. GeekSpeak is registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Al, Crazy USB of the Week.
Hello, everyone. This is Al Lucka with GeekSpeak's Crazy USB device. You know, I've been getting a little bit fed up with this digital age. Everything is going digital. For example, let's take clocks. Do you ever notice how many solid-state clocks there are out there? Well, lucky for us, there is the USB tube clock. The USB LED tube clock displays time with hour, minute, and second. Each digit glows in a single transparent tube. And yes, these are vacuum tubes you remember as a kid. I don't know about you, but I recall having to bring a bag of tubes down to the grocery store to use their tester to figure out which one was out so I could replace it. Well, it looks as if the days of tubes burning out are back with this USB clock. And I don't care what they're saying. Telling time from this thing is warmer and more rounded than a digital one. There's just a lot less clipping of time.
Thank you for the music analogy in your clocks. Al, thank you for the crazy USB of the week. Coming up next is Car Talk, and it's made possible by a grant from the Holly Family Fund at the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County, and we appreciate their support. For KOSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Stay tuned now for Car Talk.